In the modern prince, the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci commented that success in any struggle begins with an accurate estimation of the forces available on both sides, both their strengths and their weaknesses. He said this will, quote, reveal the points of least resistance at which the force of will can be most fruitfully applied. Starting from this premise, Gramsci arrived at the following generalization. The decisive element in every situation is the force permanently organized and preordered over a long period, which can be advanced when one judges that the situation is favorable. And it is favorable only to the extent to which such a force exists and is full of fighting ardor. Therefore, the essential task is that of paying systematic and patient attention to forming and developing this force, rendering it ever more homogeneous, compact, conscious of itself, unquote. This quote was cited by Cliff Slaughter, a British Marxist who was something of a mentor to the handful of young American revolutionaries that were later founded the Spartacist League, in an essay entitled, What is Revolutionary Leadership? In 1964, 40 years ago, the forerunners of the Spartacists included Slaughter's essay in a pamphlet by the same title, which was published in Berkeley here. The longshore boycott that we celebrate tonight was, in fact, successful because it targeted a point of least resistance, as Gramsci put it, in Reagan's America, at which the force of will could be most fruitfully applied. A major reason that this action succeeded was because at that time in the Bay Area, there was at least a rough approximation of what Gramsci was talking about as a politically conscious force of will, i.e. determined, politically conscious people capable of providing the necessary leadership to drive the struggle forward. And I'm speaking, for the most part, I'm speaking of a collection of former cadres of the Spartacist League who worked together and successfully negotiated some very difficult problems in the course of this struggle and overcame many obstacles, one of which, particularly at the beginning, was the Spartacist League itself, as Howard and Jack outlined. A precondition for initiating a struggle that required the willingness to defy capitalist legality was, as both Jack and Howard pointed out, an unusually high level of political consciousness within the ranks of Local 10. And the kind of selflessness that is required for class conscious action of this height by hundreds of longshoremen, because there were hundreds that took the dispatch and got fired, didn't get paid for the night, was as was outlined, it had a major impact even in South Africa. It was an unusual event. The consciousness that made this unusual event possible was the product of a long series of political struggles. Again, Jack and Howard have outlined this, but this, I think, very important to understand that this didn't just happen, and it's not likely to just happen again. It happened because a long link, a long chain of links of conscious activity, skillful, not everything was successful, but preceded this and laid the basis for this struggle. And I think that that's a very important lesson to draw, that this really came as a culmination of a decade of work. In the midst of the 11-day boycott, Howard and I were speaking at a public meeting, also in Berkeley, that had been scheduled in advance and came at a kind of inconvenient time. The title of the meeting was The Decline of the Spartacist League. Bob Mandel, who's been mentioned several times, chaired the meeting, and various people here tonight were present and spoke from the floor at it. The events at Pier 80 powerfully confirmed our prognosis that the organization that had once made some very important contributions, theoretically and practically, to the working class struggle in North America which was the Spartacist League, a Trotskyist Marxist organization at that point, was irrevocably compromised as a revolutionary formation. This was our argument. And the analysis that we presented at that meeting, at which we offered the Spartacist League 20 minutes to come and rebut us, which they ignored, of course, that analysis later appeared in a document called The Road to Jimstown. Some of you may have read it. Others who are interested in can probably pick one up at the lit table. Certainly you can find it on our website. What distinguished the SL's trade union work in its good period, before it became a degenerate fake Trotskyist organization, from others including even James P. Cannon's SWP, which was the forerunner of the SL, of course, was the conception of building the nuclei of an alternative leadership within the unions based on a program that went beyond the issues that workers confronted, but addressed those issues, addressed their immediate needs and struggles, but tied them to the necessity to overthrow capitalism and establish workers' rule on an international basis. That program, which was originally distilled from the experiences of the Russian Revolution, was codified by Leon Trotsky in 1938 as the transitional program. And the Spartacist League was, to our knowledge, the first Trotskyist organization to actually attempt to apply it within the unions. That document, too, is available on the literature table, and in addition, it includes articles on the best work from the Spartacist-supported caucuses, including Jack's MSC and Harold's Militant Caucus days. Our edition of the TP also includes an important series of articles on the history of revolutionary trade union work in America from the 1920s to the 1950s. They were written by Chris Knox, who's in attendance tonight, with significant inputs, as I understand it, from James Robertson, the central leader of the Spartacist League. The analysis presented in these articles, which stressed the importance of fighting for leadership on the basis of a revolutionary program, is explicitly acknowledged by Brian Palmer in his recent, very important book, Revolutionary Teamsters, on the series of strikes, general strikes, carried out by Trotskyists in Minneapolis in 1934. In reviewing Palmer's book, the leadership of the Spartacist League took the opportunity, after 30 years, to formally repudiate the idea of building programmatically defined caucuses, alternative leadership formations in the union. By abandoning one of their major original contributions to the Marxist movement, the degenerate Spartacist League leadership has at least helped clarify the political terrain. But of course, the profound problem of embedding socialist consciousness in the working class remains to be undertaken. It is really going to require the development and implementation of a new generation of Trotskyist cadres in the union, implantation rather, who are going to have to begin at the beginning in most places and rebuild through the kinds of steps that the Militant Caucus took, that kind of consciousness within the layers of the working class that presently exist. Because unfortunately, we don't have a lineal continuity. There are, of course, still a lot of immediate concerns that such a formation would address, whether it's stopping racist killer cop rampages or doubling the minimum wage. But at the same time, it's necessary, as the Conners and the Militant Caucus did, to address broader questions, to educate and raise the fighting spirit of the workers in preparation for larger battles in the future, and ultimately, of course, for a struggle for state power. The 1984 anti-apartheid strike we commemorate tonight provides a concrete, if small, example of how, given revolutionary leadership, the American working class in itself can one day be raised to the level of an international class for itself.